Grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
Thank you, Jim. My name is Patrick. I'm an alcoholic from Ottawa, Canada. And I realized that Jim was nervous in the truck when we left the cabin, and I figured out what it was. I figured he didn't think he'd have enough time to clear the stage after he said the word Ottawa before you people started throwing something. And all I can say is I think if Dan had known that Ottawa and Pittsburgh were going to be locked in a seven-game series, you might have had a different speaker. They gave me a badge they wanted to wear that said Ottawa, Canada. And I thought, that's like a target. And while I know that hockey is an outside issue, some of you guys might not be all that sober. Then they drove Mildred and I off way up the river. And I thought, I know what this is. This is a hostage taking. They're going to phone the Sens. They're going to say, you guys lay off, or these guys aren't getting out. And I thought, we're going to be in big trouble. Because she's from Toronto. And I'm not even a Sens fan. I mean, I watch my hockey in the old Forum in Montreal. Anyway, that's enough of Ottawa and hockey and all that, but may the best team win. I should start at the beginning and say, just get a few things out of the way straight away and say, it really is an honor and a privilege. And to be honest, it's a humbling privilege to be asked to come here and to be with you in this your place of gathering since 1950. And think of all the people who've come through here and the experience, strength, and hope that's come through here since that time. It really and truly, for me, was and is a very, very humbling privilege, and I thank you for it very much. And I thank you all, and I do get what Dan said, that really the committee is just the people who represent you, this fellowship in the Pittsburgh and greater Pittsburgh area, and I know some people from Ohio as well. But I do want to thank a few people in particular. Of course, I want to thank my host, Jim, who's been a fantastic guy to hang with the last few days. I want to thank, from the Berkeley Group, Berkeley Hills, or whatever it is. Actually, it's an honor to speak at the Berkeley Hills meeting. And I'd like to thank Tim M. from the Lawrenceville Group. And I'd like to thank Dan, your chairman, from the Lawrenceville Group. So thank you very much. My home group is Sunday Night Big Book in Orleans, Ontario, just east of Ottawa. My sobriety date is the 13th of September, 1992. And I have a sponsor in Eganville, Ontario, Errol M. Some of you might know Errol. He'll be 50 years sober this year, so he keeps me in check. And what a privilege to be here, and what a privilege, an extra little delight was the fact that we were here for Mildred's 44th, and to celebrate the cake that Laura G, gave, and to be here for Mickey. What great talks. Thank you very much, all three of you. Mildred, I've heard you a number of times, and last night, I don't know, you just get better and better. And I have the privilege, I just found out before the meeting, I have the privilege of escorting this beautiful lady back to Toronto. We're on the same flight. And Mickey, that was mind-blowing today, my friend. I spent a lot of time as a kid in London, at relatives in North London, and just your accent and your delivery and whatever, it just brought me way back, and it was a great talk. Thank you very much. And Kay, you had me in stitches. I actually think your talk should have had a toilet break. Because I nearly Couldn't hold it. I learned a lot from your talk. When you were talking about, you know, waking Gary up and pouring water over and slapping around and questioning him again, I suddenly realized now I know where water... Eleanor. What? Kay told me before the meeting, I was just telling her I really enjoyed her talk, and she said, you know, I had actually hoped to say a word on detachment. And I said, yeah, well, something I want to ask you. I've always wondered about Al-Anons. I said, you know the way you detach with love? And she said, yeah. I said, well, if you just were to momentarily, inadvertently reattach momentarily, would you have to change your date? I've always wondered that, you know. So maybe some of the Al-Anons could tell me after the meeting. You know, there's been a lot of talk up here about it's wonderful to come up here and disconnect. Get off the grid. Where we're staying up the river, you know, I was looking out in the morning. And I thought, any of us who've been thinking that have it all wrong. Have it all wrong. Because all I see around me up here is connectivity. Connectivity with the oneness of this world and this universe. Connectivity with each other. And it's been a truly remarkable experience to be here. It's a very, very unique conference. And I got to tell you some of my story and my experience, strength, and hope. I'm from Dublin, Ireland. Now, in Dublin, Ireland, Mickey said everybody drinks in England. Well, everybody drinks in Ireland, too. I like to tell the story of the guy who goes to the doctor. He was a hypochondriac Irish guy. And he always thought there was something wrong with him. Anyway, this is going on for months and months and months with the doctor. And finally, the doctor's fed up with this guy. And he said, you know something? He said, I have tested you and referred you for everything imaginable. And I can't find anything wrong with you. It must be the drink. He said, okay, doc, I'll tell you what. I'll come back someday when you're not drinking. That's the way it was in Ireland, you know. I grew up in an average working class family in Dublin. There was no active alcoholism in our family. My father was a two drink type of guy that I hated drinking with because he always nursed that second drink no matter how long you were going to be there. And I couldn't stand it. And my mother never drank. My mother never drank because her family was riddled with alcoholism. And so my mother never took the plug out of the jug, so she couldn't put the plug back into the jug. And she may have demonstrated some of the isms, but you know, that was Mom. And they were good people. I don't know why. I really don't know why. Patrick didn't seem to get enough nurturing and loving and affection as a kid. I don't know. I don't think anybody could have given me that. I don't think if Mother Teresa had been my mommy, and the Dalai Lama being my daddy, I could have got enough of that stuff. There was something there that about me that I just didn't feel connected. I didn't feel I fit in. And, you know, I grew up on the street with big families. Somebody was talking last night about being in the big, might have been Mildred, but being in a big family and being Roman Catholic. Well, I grew up on a whole street load of big families with, you know, 10 kids and 12 kids and 40, lots of kids, and I didn't feel like I fit in. And in my school, you know, in the class when I was just a little kid, it was 48 kids in the class. You know, that's not a good place if you don't feel you fit in. But anyway, and I remember being brought into school the first day with the teacher, had one arm and one leg, and my mother had the other arm and one leg. And that's the way I started my first day at school. I didn't want to be there. No idea why that was. But I do know that from a young age, I just did not feel I fit in. And my perception of myself was that I'm not capable, I'm not competent, I never thought I'd be good enough for anything else. And that was from a very, very young age. That was my perception of me. And my perception of the world was that it was a scary place, a really scary place, an anxiety-laden place. Yesterday, with the sunrise, I looked out and I felt so at one with things. I just wanted to go and bounce out into the world. And I wished I could have done that as a little kid, but it wasn't like that. I didn't go bouncing out into the world. My working hypothesis was they're not going to like me. I had no idea who they were, but I was sure they weren't going to like me. And that's just the way I started off. And so I was this nervous kid, And I was just, I felt like an outsider. I felt like an outsider in my family. I felt like an outsider on my street, at school, in my sports teams. I felt like an outsider everywhere, you know? Even in a relationship, I felt like an outsider. Like, how does that work? There's only two of us. Why am I the outsider? But it always seemed to be me. It always seemed to be me. And even when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I got to the point where I felt like an outsider, you know, 18 months into being in this fellowship. So that's how things kind of went along. And I mean, I really didn't, you know, I had an inferiority complex, but I had a superiority complex. You know, I thought I was the smartest guy I knew. You know, today I realize I was the only guy that I knew, you know. And it wasn't that I was afraid to get to know you. I was afraid you'd get to know me. That was the problem. You know, being out here in nature reminds me of an early sobriety in Montreal, and I would take our firstborn child, Kira, down to Beaver Lake to give her mother a break on a Sunday morning. And she'd be in her little one-piece suit, you know, the little one-piece the little kids have, and she'd be shuffling around there like the Michelin Man or an astronaut, you know, Neil Armstrong's first steps on the moon. And she's shuffling through the leaves, and she wanted to feed the squirrels and the ducks and all that. And it was beautiful to behold. You know, and she looked like she was completely at one with that whole surroundings. It was like she didn't know where she began and it ended, or where she ended and it began. She was just in it. And little kids can be that way. And I think we were probably all that way at one point. But you know, soon after that, this other little kid came along with her dad, and she wanted to feed the squirrels and the ducks. And so now Kira's trying to bring in more better stuff. She's trying to bribe the squirrels away, try to hip-check this kid out of the way. You know? And watching her, I think I have some idea what happened to me when I was a little kid. I started to learn language, and I think that's when the problem began. You know, I started to learn words like me and mine, yours, theirs, whatever. And I started to compare. It might have been better if they never taught me language. But when I started to compare, I never came up on the right side of that comparison, ever. Today, I have enough sense to know I don't think there is the right side of a comparison. Just don't compare. But back then, I never came up on the right side of that comparison. And that reminds me of one of my daughters got sent this. I didn't even know what I was comparing. She got sent this thing on Facebook, and it was this man, and he's standing there from the back, and he's naked. And in front of them is this massive elephant. And the elephant's saying, "How do you breathe through that thing?" and so, yeah, I don't think I even knew what I was comparing. But I was comparing. And comparison set up a conflict inside me between who I thought I was. I didn't know who I was, but who I thought I was, and who I thought you wanted me to be. And also between when you did think I was doing okay, I could never believe that. There was always this chasm. And as I say, I didn't know who I was. We had a politician in Canada, I won't name who it was because we keep party politics out of this, and he was doing what a lot of politicians do. It's right before an election, and he was going to schools and old folks' homes and all this looking for votes. And he's in this elderly person's home, and they're all enthralled with him, except for this woman. She's sitting looking out the window. So he went over to her and he said, "Excuse me, do you know who I am?" She said, "No, but if you ask the lady in the white coat, she'll tell you." Now, I didn't have to ask the lady in the white coat, but I had to come to Alcoholics Anonymous to find out a little bit of who I am. I was all kinds of people. I was whoever you wanted me to be for the longest time, you know. That reminds me of another story about a little cartoon. I think it was Larson. And it was in the Stone Age, and this guy is lying on a rock. And this Stone Age psychiatrist, he's there with a chisel and another rock, and he's taking notes, huh? And he's saying in the first frame, "When did you first suspect you might suffer from multiple personality disorder?" And the little guy in the rock says, "I don't know. I think it might have been the first time I realized I was the only person in my group therapy. And I didn't have multiple personality disorder. I'm not even sure I know what that is. But I had a lot of personalities, depending on who you were. And I learned from a young age how to observe you. And I learned from a young age how to fit in. And I learned how to sound tougher or less tough or smarter or dumber or whatever the occasion warranted to fit in, because I needed to fit in. And I learned to look like I fit in, and I learned to sound like I fit in, but I never felt like I fit in. I became this chameleon. And that's how I ventured forth. And I had three strategies for dealing with life when I came up on the wrong side of these comparisons. First one was I just became a recluse. I withdrew. I didn't go out. I'm going to stay home. I'm not playing. I'm just afraid. Or else I became a pretender and I put on a mask and I became a great pretender. And a lot of us in here became great pretenders. And I'd love to tell you that I stopped pretending when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. But that would be an outright lie. That would be an outright lie. And the third thing I did was I looked for a distraction. Anything to distract me from reality, because I couldn't deal with reality. When I got to be 12 years of age, I got a job in a bar near Dublin Airport. And when I walked in there, like I say, my family were okay. There was always three meals on our table. There was always a roof overhead. I came from good people. I came from good people. I came from good people. I came from, they were, my mom and my dad were religious. They didn't run it down our throat, but it was clear they were religious people and they were good people and we know what right and wrong was. But one thing that we didn't do well was we didn't do emotion very well. A lot of Irish people didn't seem to do emotion very well, and we didn't either. Today I understand that's part of the three R's of an Irish education: reading, writing, and guilt. You know? But that's the home I came from. And when I walked into this bar, it was like somebody had taken my black and white television and replaced it with a color television with surround sound. We did have black and white televisions. Do you remember that, Mickey? When they would say, and the team playing from left to right on your screen is Manchester, because you couldn't tell, and you couldn't see the ball, it was just snowy. But I ended up in this pub, and I think a little bit like Bill Wilson when he talked about that wafting camaraderie that was coming out of the Mayflower Hotel when he was in that pickle before he phoned the minister, went to see Dr. Bob. I fell in love with the bar from that age, because what I fell in love with was what these people seemed to have, which was camaraderie, conviviality, togetherness. And in those days, Irish people used to go out early in the evening and they'd be there all night. And they'd all have their little place staked out in the pub. And they laughed, they joked, they seemed happy to see each other. And they went out of the bar, hanging out of each other down the street. And they'd be just talking and pulling on each other. And I was waiting for the buttons to pop, you know, as they're going down. And I wanted what they had. I wanted some of this of what they had, because we didn't have that at home. And so I took steps into the stockroom to get it, and I started to tipple with a few drinks. And very shortly after that, I found myself at our school dancing a blackout. And I went to a Christian brother school, and our head brother was a guy, we used to call him Joe Moon. And Joe Moon had this big round head, totally bald, on massive industrial shoulders and no neck. He was just a huge man, about 350 pounds. And I would find myself outside the classroom sometimes for mistaken identity. And he'd be coming down the corridor and he would block out the light. And I think that's where he got the name Joe Moon, because it was like a total eclipse. And he'd come down there, and those days, corporal punishment in Ireland was all the rage in school, you know. And he'd punctuate every sentence with a punch into my solar plexus. And I'd go up against the wall and back down again. What are you doing here? Whatever. So this man, anyway, at the school dance apparently didn't like my rendition of Mick Jagger's Satisfaction on the dance floor. You know, I was strutting my stuff like a pigeon the way Mick used to do. Apparently I was knocking people over left and right, and he didn't like it. And I didn't like his criticism. So I asked him out into the schoolyard to sort this out in a manly way, put the dukes up. Now, I was skinnier then than I am now. If I didn't turn sideways and put my tongue out, I could get marked absent in school. You know? And I was a real kind of nervous kid. You know, I felt I was too tall. I haven't really grown since then in height. My feet were too long. I had the wrong face. I used to look in the mirror and say, why couldn't you just have a normal face like everybody else? There was nothing about me that seemed right, you know, nothing at all. And that awkwardness of adolescence and insecurity and the booze all mixed together, you know? And, I mean, I took size 13 feet even back then, or shoes, and my friends used to say, why don't you just ask her on board and take her for a spin? You know, at the thing, I felt like I had clown's feet. So anyway, I'm asking this guy out. Now, that's not alcoholic insanity to ask that guy out in the schoolyard for a fight. That's just being blind, drunk, in a blackout. And by blackouts, my blackouts, when I say blackout, what I mean is I would be operational for hours, usually creating chaos. No consciousness of this happening at all, and afterwards no memory of it at all. That's what my blackouts were like. And I was a blackout drinker from the beginning. And initially my blackouts weren't all that frequent. I didn't drink that much when I was at, you know, 12 years of age, maybe six times a year. But it got to the stage where I was blacking out all the time. My last drunk wasn't in a blackout, and I'll get to that later, and I'm glad it wasn't in a blackout. But I was a blackout drinker, and for those of you who don't know what that is, it's like a magical mystery tour, because I'd wake up in places I never expected to be in, you know? And even years later, I'd start drinking in Montreal and wake up in New York, you know? I'd wake up in places and wonder, who are all these people and what are we all doing in bed together? You know? And how do I get out of here without waking any of them up? You know, and then I'm rooting around in a drawer, you know, for a phone bill or an invoice. So when I phone the taxi, I can give them an address, tell the dispatcher where I am, because you can't say, well, I don't know. And anyway, I might have been a walk from home, and that was the money on the taxi. But that was it with blackouts for me. And, you know, sometimes I look, somebody outside was saying to me, we're talking about dress, and somebody said they changed the dress code. And I said, well, yeah, maybe it's kilts. He said, yeah, you do well in a kilt. And a few people have mistaken me for a Scot, but the Scots and the Irish are quite different in many ways. We get on very well, but we're quite different. And I just want to say about the Scots and the Irish, they're both great people, but you got to watch the ones who are half Scots and half Irish, because the Scottish guy, you know, they're dodgy. The Irish guy always wants to get drunk, and the Scottish guy, Scottish half of them never wants to pay for it. You know, that's the way that is. But I do wonder about the Scots and the Irish, because everywhere I've been in the world, and I travel a lot mainly for work, and no matter where I've been, I run into Irish, and I ran into an Irish guy there from Galway in Boston, right? He's in Boston right now, friend of Coleman's son. And what is it about us? I think we were just guys that went down for a drink in our local pub, and we woke up in a blackout in Tasmania or, you know, Boston, Canada, whatever. Because nothing else explains the dispersion of the Irish and the Scots in the world. It defies normal distribution patterns if you look at it from a statistical point of view. Well, then were my blackouts, and they really were scary. I remember I was doing business in Birmingham with this guy, and he was a fairly young guy. He bought this business, and I was having lunch with him. And after a while, when I got to know him, he told me he was an ex-SAS guy. And the SAS are like the special services in the UK. They're some of the best troops in the world. And he's told me that in their basic training, they'll be dropped into hostile territory. Years ago, they used to do it in Northern Ireland. They dropped them in there, no resources, no money, no whatever, and they'd have to make their own way out without being detected and back to base. It was part of the basic training. And as he's telling me this, I'm thinking, this is just like blackouts, isn't it? I mean, a lot of us should get an exemption from some of the basic training of the SAS, you know? Because we're pretty... Anyway, enough of that. You know, after that school dance, two things happened. The first one was on the Monday, well, actually, the next day, on the Saturday, I went to play a football game, and my friends told me what had happened at the school dance, and I couldn't believe it. I was absolutely certain they were just yanking my chain. This didn't happen. It was my first blackout. But as was to happen in the future, things would be corroborated by others. And news came down from the school, because the school actually was, there were six religious brothers that lived beside the school, and the rest of the teachers were lay teachers. And word came down from the school that Patrick should go up and make an account of himself. And so I went up to make an account of myself before the school week began on the Sunday. And I met Brother Loughran, Joel Moon. And he said to me, you seem like a nice kid. I just started that school, our secondary school, the equivalent of your high school. And he said, you know, you seem like a nice kid. But when you drink, what I remember him saying was, you're like a little animal. I don't know if he said that, but I know it wasn't complimentary, and that's what I remember him saying. He was first of many, many people to tell me the same thing. You know, Patrick, when you drink, there's something wrong with you. When you don't drink, you're an okay guy. And my parents told me that, My siblings told me that. My friends told me that. My teenage friends used to say, you know, Patrick, when we drink, we have fun, and when you drink, we don't. You know, employers told me that. Soccer coaches told me that. Teammates told me that. Fellow employees told me that. Business partners told me that. Counselors told me that. I did a little bit of counseling, trying to figure out what was wrong. Police told me that. Lawyers told me that. Judges told me that. Probation officers told me that. They all told me the same thing. So when I got here, all you had to tell me was, you know, when you don't drink, you seem like a nice guy, and when you drink, there's something wrong with you, so don't drink. I'd probably still be drinking, because with no disrespect to anybody here, some very well-credentialed people and well-meaning and loving people had told me that. But that's the way I was, and I didn't know why I drank like that. It's like Mickey said today, I had no more idea. You know, when people said, why did you do it? Not what did I do in the blackout, because I didn't know what I did in the blackout, but why did you do it? Why did you do it again? I had no more idea than the man on the moon. And you know, Patrick would a drink and Patrick without a drink. They were like a couple where she worked nights and he worked days. And they just met on the doorstep, coming in and out of a drunk. They were just like two different people. And when people ask me, why did I do it again? And I have no more idea, because like them, by the time I saw the white rabbit, the trick was over, right? I mean, I don't know why I drank again. I just drank again. I think I know today why I drank again, because the state of mind before I drank was so ratcheted up to the hilt with anxiety. And my perception was so out of order, because for me, not being able to differentiate the truth from the false is not after I drink, it's before. And it was so ratcheted up to high dough on the scale. It was so completely different. Afterwards, when I was visited by the four horsemen, the terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair, I was more like the social drinkers. You know, my anxiety had been alleviated or brought down. I was deflated, and I was thinking in a different way. It was like two different states of mind. And I tried to give up drinking first when I was 14 years of age. And until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I never got more than 3 weeks. Never got more than 3 weeks, you know. No matter what I did, you know, and the first paragraph I related to in the book was where it says, we are incapable. Not we were, we are incapable of keeping in our consciousness with sufficient force the pain, the memory of the pain, humiliation, or suffering of even a week or a month ago. That explained my life when I read it. I always seemed to just find myself drinking again. It didn't matter about the fear. It didn't matter about the promises. It didn't matter about information. You know, right on the cabin next to us, there's two Ronnies. There used to be the two Ronnies in England. You remember them? Ronnie Corbett and Ronnie Barker. And they had this great show on TV. And one of the little stints they used to do was like the news. They did this mock news thing, you know. And I always remember one where this woman comes in, they're reading the news, and this woman comes in and slips a little piece of paper onto the desk, and I think it was Ronnie Corbett picks up and says, oh, and now this just fresh in. This is about the East German pole vaulting champion who has just become the West German pole vaulting champion. That was like my alcoholism. It didn't matter how I built my wall with fear, information, anything else, promises, whatever, resolutions. Alcoholism just seemed to pole vault the wall. All the time. I felt like I was getting mugged in a cellar, you know, at midnight with the lights off. I couldn't figure it out. I had no idea. What was happening really was that I would start to get restless, irritable, and discontented. You know, sometimes we don't question terminology in the program. 2 weeks ago, I was thinking about that. I was thinking the doctor, you know, the doctor observed alcoholics, but the doctor wasn't an alcoholic. I don't think alcoholics would have used those three words. I probably would have said scared and anxious and all these sort of things. But I would get restless, irritable, and discontented. And I don't know about you, but they always ganged up on me together. I rarely got irritable without getting restless and discontented. And I rarely got discontented without, you know, I don't think I ever did, actually. So they always came in threes. And that would build and build. It would just be like a tuning fork. It would start to hum. And then that whole feedback would start happening. I always think it's like putting a microphone in front of a speaker, and it would just amplify and re-amplify and re-amplify the anxiety, and it would get to panic proportions. And when it got to panic proportions, I drank. Now, like our speaker said this afternoon, I don't ever remember walking into a bar saying, you know something, my level of restlessness, irritability, and discontentment is at a kind of critical level, and I need a drink. I didn't do that. It was like Pavlov's dog. The bell rang, the dog salivated, food's coming. I got like that, I drank, I just drank. That's what happened every time I drank. And as I say, you know, by the time I was drinking, it was all over. It was all over. So that's the way I was growing up. And you know, I left Ireland, I came to Canada. By the time I left Ireland, I didn't really need to leave Ireland, but it was kind of, it was a lot of humiliation to leave behind and embarrassment. And I moved out to Canada. And I went to Winnipeg, and I worked in Manitoba and Saskatchewan and Alberta and up into the Arctic and Yellowknife, and then back to Manitoba and then down to Los Angeles, back to Manitoba. I don't know what was going on in Manitoba. And then down to Toronto and Montreal in 6 years. And I did a lot of geographicals. And I can tell you, that gets expensive when you get around to doing your ninth step, because you got to go on tour, you know? And I've made amends in all those places. My first boss in Winnipeg, a nice guy, Scottish guy, and we'd get poured onto planes in the Arctic or wherever else to come back down south. And I'm not saying he was one of us, but if he showed up here, I wouldn't tell him he was in the wrong place. And I had 6 jobs with him. The first one, he fired me 3 times, and I quit 3 times. And I remember going down with my wife, actually. We were in San Francisco, and we drove down to Los Angeles to Rancho Morango. He was in Rancho Morango near Palm Springs. I went out to make amends to him. And he said, not at all, Patrick. You know, we were just having a bit of fun. It was just all in good fun. And then as he had a few more Remy Martins, that was his cognac of choice, he thought, you know, maybe there were a few things that were a little off color. And I remember standing under his grapefruit tree, I think it was, the only time I've ever done that, under a grapefruit tree. And he got so angry, and he said to me, the nerve of you even coming down here and looking me in the eye after what you did to me. So that was one of those kind of funny amends, but I went and I tried to do my bit. Anyway, you know, in Canada, I moved around. I'm not going to take you through a big drunkalogue, but you know, I could never deal with the ordinary. I was always looking for the extraordinary, and I was always looking for the unknown. You know, I was bored with the known. But the trouble about the unknown is it becomes known as soon as you know it. You know, a good friend of ours told me once, nothing's wonderful when you've had it for a while. And that's been true for me, you know. And so I moved around all those things, but you know, it's hard to settle in one place when you don't know what you're looking for. And it's hard to settle for one relationship. And I met some good women along the way when you don't know what you're looking for. And it's hard to settle for any one job or any one company when you don't know what you're looking for. And I was like that U2 song. I didn't know what I was looking for. I still hadn't found what I was looking for. I was chasing something that I thought was going to complete me. All this time from a young age, I still never suspected I was suffering from a spiritual malady. But I was looking for something to complete me out there. And I'd fix on something, and I'd think, okay, this is it. This would make the difference. And while I was working towards that, I would think, okay, this is going to make a difference, and I'd feel a little bit better, and then I'd get it, and after a while, it was just the same old thing. Nothing's wonderful when you've had it for a while. And I'd get restless, irritable, discontented all over again. And I'd get anxious even when there was nothing going wrong in my life, you know? Today I realized I just had a faulty radar system. There was nothing out there. I was just picking it up on the radar system, you know. It's like I had a search engine in here in my brain. And based on its sort of premise that nothing's going to be okay and nothing's going to work out okay, it always just went off searching all the time for what was wrong. Most of the time there was nothing wrong, but I'd wake up feeling that way. And so I'd fix on something. I'd say, it's Jim's fault. And then I'd kind of focus on that, and I'd convince myself it was Jim's fault. But that was the way things would just work for me, you know. And to this day, I have to watch that. Anyway, I met the woman that was become my wife in in Toronto, in a pub near the Maple Leaf Gardens. And shortly thereafter, I was in another blackout. And we were sitting, some of my workmates and some of her workmates, in a little pub there. And I drank into a blackout. And in full earshot of the whole assembly, I propositioned one of her best friends from work, this young Welsh girl. And I explained to her what gymnastics we could engage in when we got back to my place and hit the sheets. And Linda was not at all impressed. And the next day she called me to tell me she didn't want to see me again. But she felt duty-bound to tell me that she thought I had a problem with alcohol and I ought to do something about it. Believe it or not, at the time I had a spiritual director because I kind of had this idea I wanted to become a Jesuit. And I had a spiritual director down on Bay Street in St. Stephen's Church. And I went down to see him. He was a blind man called Mario. And Mario said to me, "No, Patrick, there's a guy up at St. Gabriel's Church in North York. And he's a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he's an alcohol and addictions counselor." I went up to see this guy. His name was Joe Cushing. And Joe's dead now. To my understanding, Joe was one of the first 10 guys sober in Toronto. What I remember Joe telling me, "Patrick, you couldn't be an alcoholic. You'd be the last person standing in front of me asking that question." And so I went back and I told Linda that. He said, "I'm just a heavy drinker." I bumped into, I was at a sponsorship day in Toronto many, many years later with my sponsor, and I bumped into a good friend, I made a good friend that day, a guy called Dave Church. And I asked Dave about this guy, and Dave said, "You know something? If you go to the Leaside group of Alcoholics Anonymous tomorrow morning, you'll meet Joe." So I said to my sponsor, "Do you mind leaving town a little later? We go to this meeting in the morning?" So Earl said, "Okay." And we went. And I got the chance to stand and hold and to talk to Joe and to hold his hand and say the Lord's Prayer at the end of the meeting. And I'd managed to get back to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was very grateful that I had. But I told Joe what I thought he said to me, and he said, "You know something, kid? I was about 40 years sober when I met you, and I was on pretty dry ground. And I never said to a human being what you think I said to you." And that just made me realize how we can rationalize things and hear what it is that we want to hear. So anyway, I moved to Montreal, and Linda was like the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. She was going to get her man, and she followed me and tracked me down, and she got her man. And she got a lot more for her troubles. And our relationship was like an on-again, off-again situation. It was like a real bad country and western song, where every verse got worse and worse, and the choruses were breaking up and making up. And I really, really, I never laid a finger on Linda, but my God, I led her a merry dance. And I'd come home at all hours, you know. Because I could just go for one drink and go back 2-3 days later, you know. When I'd been living in Toronto before I went to Montreal and was going to set up a business in Montreal, getting all these jobs for nothing, I'll tell you here's how the obsession seemed to work with me. I'd go to Montreal the night before. All I had to do the next day was show up, meet the bankers, meet the developers, meet the lawyers, meet whoever, meet the contractor. We were going to get this job. I remember the first one was this tower that burnt down opposite the old forum. We didn't even have to bid for it. There wasn't a cloud on the horizon, you know, as it says in the book. And yet I got all anxious. I got all nervous. Because you see, I always thought they were going to find me out. I always thought she was going to realize I'm not the guy she thinks I am and move on. Or my employer was going to find out I'm not the employee. Or my client was going to find out I'm not the guy that they think I am and dump me. And so success made it worse. To be honest, success just upped the ante. Success made me think I can't sustain this. And from that young age, when I didn't feel I was good enough and I didn't feel I was liked and all that, I developed a pattern of having to be useful. I didn't feel loved just for who I was. I had to have a function. I had to be useful, you know, I had to be something. And so even in the business with my partners, I always felt I had to be pulling off the big play, you know, the Super Mario play, you know, not the ordinary stuff, not the journeyman stuff, you know. It never dawned on me that I was hired just to do an honest day's work for an honest day's pay. I always had to try and do the extraordinary. Why? Because I needed the pats on the back and the accolades. But when I got the pats on the back and the accolades, I couldn't believe them. And as I got more pats on the back and more accolades, the chasm between who they thought I was and who I thought I was just got worse and worse and worse. So I'd arrive in town in Montreal. All I had to do was get an early night's sleep and be bright-eyed and bushy-tailed the next day, and I'd go drinking. You know, and I'd ask the hotel to wake me up in the morning. I'd have several alarms around my room. And I always ended up in the seedy part of town. I don't know why, but I did. And the next morning, I'd be there, and I'd have red lace curtains for eyes. I'd be going down Rennie Levesque Boulevard looking for Visine for my eyes before I went to this meeting with a pounding head as though somebody had lifted my skull and poured in battery acid. And I'm going in there and I'm thinking, they know where I've been. And why did I drink? There was no reason for me to drink. And when I was in Montreal, I'd have to go down to Toronto for a morning meeting, and I'd take an early flight on Rapid Air. Supposed to be back in the afternoon. I'd finish the meeting with a banker or a joint venture partner, somebody, and I'd be heading back to the airport, and I'd stop for one drink. Did you ever stop for one drink? You know? A while later, I'd walk out and I'd phone Air Canada, and I'd say, have you any room on your 1 o'clock flight? Put me on the 1 o'clock, please. I'd go back to the bar. I'd be back out of any room on your 3 o'clock flight? Any room on your 5? What's your last flight tonight? What's your first flight tomorrow morning? And I might get back to Montreal 2-3 days later. Linda got fed up with this and the on and off stuff. And Linda just upped and moved to Kingston, Ontario to start a new life for herself. She's just getting on with it. Meanwhile, I still continue this behavior. So the same thing had happened. I'd arrive back in Montreal and four horsemen would be there, and I'd be petrified. I'd just be scared, and I couldn't get out of bed. And I couldn't even call my secretary that I hired and tell her the truth. The truth was, I was just afraid to get out of bed. I was petrified. I don't know what I was afraid of. It was an unspecifiable fear. I just had this fear. And so I'd concoct some symptoms of some imaginary illness I was supposed to have. And tell her I couldn't come in. I'd come in a few days later, and the guys were keeping the business afloat, the guys working for me. And then I'd get in there very, very sheepishly, very embarrassed, and I'd just ease into work, and then I'd get really going at work, and then I'd get alcoholic or workaholic with the work, and then we'd have a deadline, we'd hit the deadline, I'd say to the guys, let's go for a drink to celebrate, and we'd be off all over again, you know. That's how it was. And Linda, you know, I abandoned Linda in South Boston, I abandoned Linda on a holiday in Costa Rica. I mean, I just really wasn't a good boyfriend. You know, and I wasn't a good son, and I let so many people down. I let cousins down. I let my mom, I remember that, messing up my cousin's kid's christening, and when I let my mother's brother down when he needed my help, and I just left him in the lurch. That's the type of guy I'd become, totally, totally, totally unreliable. Anyway, when Linda went, I thought, good riddance. You know, and I just went drinking. I was drinking down the east end of Montreal at this stage, because you get gun-shy when you find out you've been rolling around Alexander's Pub on Peel Street, punching the head off one of your neighbors at your work because you thought he was checking out the barmaid who only had eyes for you, you know? And so I didn't drink anywhere I was known. And I just started to drift further and further into isolation. And I was auguring down into madness. I was really auguring down into madness, you know? That's what I figured. I was going to end up either in prison if I'd have gotten what I deserved, because I was a very violent, destructive, angry young man at that time. Or somebody was going to take me down the back lane and just do a little bloodletting and save on the paperwork. Or else I was going to end up insane. I remember going to visit Linda in Kingston. I was supposed to be sleeping in a spare room. And I was in their dining room with a hardwood floor with a tablecloth wrapped around me. She came in and said, what's wrong? And I said, they're all talking about me. I'm starting to imagine things. And I'm starting to hear voices, you know. I read a few years ago that a British surgeon in the British Army, there was a lot of Irish guys in the British Army out in India, and he actually believed that the leprechauns, the Irish belief in the leprechauns, was a manifestation of the DTs. And, you know, and I wouldn't be surprised. But that's where I ended up. I ended up completely alone. I wasn't in touch with my family. Even my drinking friends were gone. They were drinking at a different rate. And I was just really, I thought I was at my bottom. In a way, I was at my bottom. For being sober, but not for sobriety. And I went to Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I'd been introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous a few times. At that school dance, the brother had brought in a guy to speak to us in the main room, in the art room, and he put me sitting in the front row, a guy from public information. I couldn't relate to him. And we had a neighbor on our street, Dorothy, and she asked me if I thought there was something bizarre about my drinking. But I thought there was something bizarre about Dorothy. She had discovered God in Alcoholics Anonymous and wanted to tell the whole world. And then in Ipawan, Manitoba, I had a friend, she was with the Winnipeg Jets. And her dad was out in Ipawan, Manitoba, Bud H. And Bud was a stand-up guy. He was about 25 years sober back then. And Bud talked to me about my drinking. But, you know, I wasn't ready. You know, I think when we're ready to come in here, we're like an apple ready to just fall into the palm off the tree. We don't have to be cut or twisted or anything else. We're just ready. And I wasn't ready. But now I was ready. And I called Alcoholics Anonymous when I got back to Montreal. My last drunk was a very, very destructive, angry, aggressive affair, very violent. I've been through it, my fifth step. I'm not going to get into it here. And I'm glad it wasn't in a blackout, because there was something about that last drunk that broke through the delusion, because I didn't suffer from denial. Because to suffer from denial, to deny something, I have to know it to be true and refuse to admit it. But I didn't know I had a twofold illness. I didn't know that. I didn't understand alcoholism until I got here. I had lived it. Life brought me the first step, but you helped me put a label on it. But I didn't know it till I got here. But something about that last drunk broke through the delusion. Something about that last drunk. See, before that, I was always able to say, you know, that time in Costa Rica was a disaster. You know, when I messed up my cousin's kid's christening, it was a catastrophe. You know, this was a write-off. That was a lost opportunity. There was something about my last drunk that I was able to see that my whole life was nothing more than the sum total of all these missed opportunities and disasters and write-offs strung back to back. And the time between them was getting less and less. And what was going on in them was getting worse and worse and more serious. A long, 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 long way from that childhood problem at the school dance. And I didn't see the light and I didn't feel the heat when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. There was nobody left in my life to turn up the heat, to be perfectly frank. You know, I didn't see the light. Although Alcoholics Anonymous became the light by which I see today, but I didn't see the light back then. And I came to Alcoholics Anonymous out of cowardice. And I'm glad I had that cowardice, because I was just afraid to drink. I was afraid of the magical mystery tours. I was afraid of what was going to happen. And I was afraid not to drink. And so I came to Alcoholics Anonymous in Montreal. First night, I met the woman who was to become, I met the woman, Dorothy, and she introduced me to the man who was to become my sponsor when she found out it was my first meeting, Les B. And Les was just a fantastic guy. Les was just a great guy, and I had him for 3.5 years, and I realized today that in that 3.5 years, Les gave me everything I needed. And it's taken me a long time to unpack that. Our speaker last night said if you're around 44 years, maybe you'll understand some of this. So it's taken me a lot of time to understand what Les told me in some of those first few years. But Les was a great guy, and he used to tell me that I was human, only more so. And he used to tell me that an alcoholic is a man or woman with their feet firmly planted in midair. You know? And he used to tell me that sitting on a seat in Alcoholics Anonymous will not turn you into a happy, contented ex-problem drinker. Just like sitting on an egg won't turn you into a chicken. And Les was a fantastic guy. And you know, Les basically told me what had happened to him and what he had done. That's all Les did. Les talked about him. He didn't talk about me. And we'd meet twice a week in his kitchen, and another 2 times a week at a little deli near the Blue Bonnets race course called Crickets. And Les would just tell me what was going on, and tell me what he had done, blah, blah, blah. And I just love this man. I just love this man. But you know, my early sobriety, it took me a long time to get the first step. It took me 18 months to get the first step without drinking. You know, I'd heard that early recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous is like waking up in a minefield. You follow the fellows who don't blow up. And that's what I was doing. I was following the fellows that didn't blow up. But I wasn't doing what they were doing. I wasn't doing that at all. My arrogance, my conceitedness, my big-headedness, my intellect was still there. You know? I'd go to meetings and I wasn't even listening to what the last guy was saying. I'm trying to decide, what am I going to say? You know? And then I'd say it. Get it out of the way. You think then I could relax and enjoy the meeting. But instead I'm thinking, I wonder if they understood that. You know, it was all about me, you know? It was just ego, all ego. I was trying to impress people. I was back into the pretense. I didn't see that at the time, but that's what I was. I learned to talk the talk, but I wasn't walking the walk. As I say, I wasn't doing what those guys were doing that weren't blowing up, you know? And I'd go to meetings. I'm sure some of you went to meetings. Nice summer night in Montreal. Let me go for coffee afterwards, all sitting around. We'd sort out the problems of the world. I'd feel wonderful. Drive home. What a starry night. Just gorgeous. Had a little moment when I get out of the car to go into the apartment. Like, this is great. It's all on the up and up now. And then I'd wake up the next morning and I'd just be racked with fear. Complete fear. I used to have a sound system and it had an amp. It had a cassette player. And a turntable playing through it. And when the electricity went off, I don't know why this was, when the electricity went off, when it came back on, it was always the radio tuner that came back on, the radio. So I said to this guy, I went, why is that? He said, well, that's its factory setting. That's its default setting. Well, that was my default setting. I had the kind of sobriety, or sobriety, I've heard it described as, you know, that kind of warm, comfortable feeling of wetting the bed. You know, momentarily, I'm warm and comfortable and whatever. But shortly thereafter, I'm just cold and miserable and humiliated. The shelf life of my sobriety was terrible. So anyway, I hadn't done the work. You know, I hadn't done the work. I was making it really, really, really complicated and nearly kill me. Now, a sponsor of mine, and he's got two little girls, and their grandmother was visiting, and she bought them two little kites at a dollar store. And so they're sitting down, and one of the little girls, Georgia, she ripped the kite out of the packet, and her grandmother said, hold on a minute there, Georgia, let's read the instructions. So she's pulling out that accordion list, you know, 57 languages, looking for the English, going up and down. Meanwhile, Georgia has her kite put together. My grandma said, Georgia, I told you to read the instructions. She said, you know, Nana, it's just too simple for you to understand. And that's what the problem was for me in Alcoholics Anonymous. It was just too simple for me to understand. I was trying to make it complicated. I was stuck on the dash in the first step. I hadn't passed that dash, that hyphen. I met a guy today, Ken, with a dog called Dash. I was stuck on that dash. And the three pertinent ideas to me were really important. They really helped me with the first step because, you see, I was stuck there. I knew I was powerless over alcohol. I knew that, you know. But God could and would if you were sought, you know. I wasn't looking for God to do it. I thought with my ego that if I just listen to enough of you guys, and I go to a couple of weekends, go on some men's intensive retreats, read the books, get some whatever, whatever, I can fix me in the privacy and comfort of my own home without having to expose my warts and all to anybody. And that nearly killed me because I ended up 18 months in Alcoholics Anonymous without a drink when I realized I had a not drinking problem that was worse than my drinking problem. And I just wanted to kill myself. And I had to get down to causes and conditions, you know. I had to get down to causes and conditions. And I was to learn that there was only one condition that mattered in my life, and that was my spiritual condition. And if that was okay, I'd be okay. But I didn't know that at the beginning. As I say, I hadn't done the work. 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous are like a coffee grinder. You don't put any beans in there, you ain't going to get any coffee. And the beans I had to put in were the beans of my life, because the truth about my life will set me free. The truth about my life won't set you free, but the truth of your life will set you free. You know? And I thought I could just cruise. I thought I had done my steps. I'd written a fourth step that was like a screenplay. And it was complete, utter junk, and it took me forever to write it. You know? I basically hadn't done the steps. The 12 steps to me seem to be like the combination to a safe. You need all the numbers to open it, you know? So I had to get back to that, and so I went back and I realized I had come, somebody talked today about surrender and admissions or whatever, but, you know, I had admitted I was an alcoholic when I came here. But that's an admission, it's not a surrender, you know? And in the second step, I came to belief, I developed a belief. But that's a belief. It's not a surrender. And in the third step, I made a decision. I think a lot of us have made decisions and not followed up in any action. I know I have. It was just a decision. So I had to get down to cause and conditions in the fourth step. And what I realized, being an Irish Catholic by birth anyway, I always thought that the fourth step was confessional in nature. And I was to learn it is educational in nature. And I was to learn that the chapter in the big book, How It Works, should probably be called How It Doesn't Work. Because the book tells me more about how it doesn't work than how it works. Now, I think Bill wrote the book backwards. You know, if you look at the four absolutes, he almost wrote the book backwards, you know. I think Bill realized that we alcoholics don't know much about honesty, but we know a lot about dishonesty. And if I can just back out of dishonesty, I'll back up into honesty without knowing it. And if I can just back up out of selfishness little by little, I might back into selflessness without knowing it. And if I can back out of fear little by little, I might back up into faith without knowing it. And I was to learn about my resentments and my wrongdoings and my fears. And my resentments were really about how I hadn't, my perception of how I hadn't got my way in the past. And my fears were that I wouldn't get my way in the future, 5 minutes from now, 5 years from now, whatever. And my wrongdoings were the things that I did to try and straighten up that playing field so I'd get what I needed. And I only stole because I didn't think that life and its bounty would provide for me. And I only lied to you because I didn't think you'd accept me for who I was. But you know, the lies I told you were only half the problem. Worse still were the lies I told myself, the lies I'd been telling myself from a young age. And I realized that my resentments served a great purpose. They helped me to justify my isolation. I learned that fears ran my entire life. I learned I was a snob. I learned that there was half of the world that I had met that seemed to know what they were doing. And they intimidated me because they made me feel inadequate. They seemed to know what they were doing. They had 5-year plans. They knew what they wanted to be when they grew up. I never knew what I wanted. I still don't know what I want to be if I grow up. So I wrote them off and I assassinated their characters and I told you what was wrong with them. I concocted all kinds of slander. And then there was another half of the population that in my mind, I'm not saying they were worse off than me, but in my mind they were worse off than me. And I didn't want to hang around with them because guilt by association, you might think I'm like that. And then I wondered why I'm lonely in the middle. And for a guy who'd felt ignored and rejected, I realized I was the one that had done the rejection. I realized I had kept you all away because I was afraid of you getting to know me because of what I thought about me. And that was my fifth step. Well, that was my fourth step. My fifth step, you know, to God, to a human, to God, to ourselves, another human being, to God for forgiveness, to myself for understanding, and to another human being for humility. Then I went my sponsor. It's interesting when out here in the forest, because I've been told when I first came to Alcoholics Anonymous, if it took you 10 years to get lost in the forest, it might take you 10 years to get out. Les was the first guy, you know, that was the first surrender. When I first started to level with Les, that was a surrender. You can't be surrendered when you're still packing, but you know, you can't be surrendered unless you throw everything down. And in the fifth step, I threw everything down. And in the fifth step, I leveled with one human being for the first time in my life, and I found that I was no better and no worse than anybody else. And he shared his experience with me. It was a two-way street, you know. I was in my fifth step. And that was when the surrender began. That was when the real identification began, as opposed to the comparing. And I learned for the first time that the only antidote I know for isolation, the isolation of an alcoholic, is identification. It's the only thing I know. Information, fear, alcoholism always pole vaulted that. Identification. And Les created a little clearing in the rainforest for the first time and got me to laugh at myself and got me to stand back and got me to get some perspective in my life. And that's what Alcoholics Anonymous continues to do for me today, give me perspective. You know? And I saw that, you know, I used to think that people didn't understand me and that was the problem. In my fifth step, I found out I didn't understand me. That was the problem. You know? So what? And I realized that other people had been judging me by my actions, whereas I had been judging me by my intentions all those time. And there was a huge disconnect between my intentions and my actions. So that's what I learned. And then but you know, when you've done the fifth step, all you know is what's wrong. Still haven't done anything about it, you know? So I had to try and do something about that in 6 and 7, you know? And 6 and 7 to me, like there's a hockey game going on right now, in case anybody didn't know. 6 and 7 to me is like trying to do in real time what I found out with my sponsor works and not do what didn't work. It's like if you play hockey, you play football or anything else, and your coach pulls you aside. That game last week, Patrick, you kept getting pulled out of position over there, and you just messed up our whole shape, and you created an opening, and bing, bang, boom, the puck was in the back of the net. I'm thinking, well, that's easy for you to say. You've got a chalkboard in 20 minutes to explain all that, but this was happening in a split second. And that guy was about to bury me into that board, so I was going to be a fossil sometime 14 centuries from now. So I'm trying to do it in real time, and that isn't easy. I like to tell the story of having lunch with a sponsor of mine in Ottawa, and we had a great lunch, and we walked out of there like two spiritual gurus, both of us. We had such a great lunch. I'm walking back to work, totally serene, and I'm crossing O'Connor, and I was a little bit late leaving the pavement, and this guy in a red Camaro went steaming by, and he screams out the window, and I won't swear from the podium of Alcoholics Anonymous, but he swore my family back in operatic vulgarities, and you know, in a quicker than an Olympic athlete on steroids, I was right back out there in the middle of the street. That's where my serenity went. Because there was nothing between the stimulus and the response. I didn't have that space. I didn't have that perspective. And I've realized today that's why I need to pause when agitated. I have to try and find that space. So that was my 6th and 7th. And my 8th and 9th, I became willing to my experience of being unwilling. I have to tell you that right along every step of the way in Alcoholics Anonymous, I become willing to my experience of being unwilling. So if you're new or not new and you're sitting here tonight and you're unwilling, you're right on track. Because my unwillingness made me willing when it got painful enough, you know. And, you know, in terms of pain, I just want to say this in my particular case. Over the years, I had people who offered to take that pain away at the stroke of a pen. And I'm just glad in my particular case that I didn't go down that road. And the only reason I say that is because that pain was like gold dust for me. Because that pain, without that pain, I never would have known that the message you guys were giving me was the truth. Because the only thing that has ever dissolved that pain for me has been the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. The only thing that's ever dissolved that pain for me has been identifying with one other alcoholic one at a time. That was talked about today. We have conferences, we have meetings, we have this, we have that and the other. To me, they're like the vectors. You know, in pharmaceutical business, you get vectors and you get essential ingredients. The essential ingredient is one alcoholic talking to one other alcoholic one at a time. That, to me, is Alcoholics Anonymous. The rest is the vector, the dressing. It's the situation we find ourselves in. So I had to get around and make some amends there. And, you know, my sponsor explained it. My sponsor was a Jewish man, and he used to talk to me about Yom Kippur. And he used to say to me, Patrick, Yom Kippur is the Day of Atonement. And to atone means to become at one, atone, A-T-O-N-E. I don't have anything for that yet, but you can work one out. And he told me that there was no point trying to atone with your God before you atoned with your fellow man. And Les explained to me that you can't build a spiritual relationship with your higher power on a faulty moral foundation. And I realized what I was trying to do. I was trying to feel at one with the world. I was trying to straighten out those relationships so I could look the world in the eye. I had 3 business partners. I swore I would never make amends to them. Some years later, I went back to live in Ireland, and I was still having conversations with one of my business partners as I was chopping the vegetables for the evening stew. And I'm thinking what I'm going to say to that guy should I ever run into him at an airport. And that ought to give you a clue that there's some wreckage of the past that needs taken care of. So I phoned him up, and he lived in Mississauga, Ontario, and he arranged to meet me in Port Credit. And he said he'd meet me in Port Credit, Ontario, but he could only do it at 6 o'clock in the morning because he was going to play golf. So I met him at 6 o'clock in the morning, and I made my amends. And all I can tell you is that when I did that, and when I made amends with my other two business partners, something opened up for me in Alcoholics Anonymous that wasn't open before. Something in terms of freedom or a vein of serenity. Step 10. My sponsor told me that Bill Wilson's secretary messed it all up. She forgot to write the second half of that step, or type it, which was, "And when you're right, keep your mouth shut." And I have done more harm in life when I've been right than when I've been wrong. When I've been wrong, I usually leave the scene of my wrongness. I skulk off around the corner, excuse myself, or get out. But when I'm right, I can hang your laundry out to dry for everybody to see. So I have to be careful about that. I can be very quick, and I don't know who it was that said, "Oh, let us watch that something errant member of the tongue." But I have to be careful. I can be far too smart sometimes and hurt people. Step 11 for me, I got far too clever with step 11. I got far too complicated with that, I really did. Today I try and keep it real simple. My concept of a higher power has evolved and evolved over time. It really has. And I like Seamus Heaney's an Irish poet, and he's a beautiful poem about building a wall. And he talks about we can let down our scaffold now that we've built our wall. There's a lot of practices that I used to practice that I don't practice anymore, but they served the purpose of that time. And I've let them down as I've built my wall. And so that's continued to evolve. And my sponsor always tells me that he got sober in Orange County, and he always tells me that Chuck Chamberlain told him, "We're infinite children on an infinite journey to an infinite creator." And certainly, my spiritual experience seems to be just an infinite unfolding, and it just seems to keep evolving. And I like to tell the story about the young girl in England, probably northwest London. And she's drawing, and the art teacher said, "What are you doing?" She said, "I'm drawing God." She said, "Well, that's silly. Nobody knows what God looks like." She said, "You give me 15 minutes and I'll show you." So whatever your concept is of God, don't let anybody knock you off it. Whatever your concept is of a higher power. I try to keep it real simple today. I like the 10th and 11th step. I particularly like the 11th step because I think it's a great barometer. Because when it comes to spiritual condition, I don't multitask very well. I don't do resentments and fit spiritual condition very well. I really don't. I can't meditate and have a resentment. It just doesn't seem to work. It's just like it jams the phone lines. Like back in the Cold War, the States used to jam all the Russian phone lines and radio lines. That's just, it jams the lines. I just can't get through. I can't be in contact. So it brings me back to that Yom Kippur thing of straightening myself out with whoever it is, or straighten out the problems always inside me before I move on with that. The last three steps, I realized today that the first 9 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous extricated me from the wreckage of the past. And the last 3 steps keep me out of the worry and projectionism of tomorrow or whenever in the future, And when I can do that, I find myself here right now where I could never be, But I can't just hold on to that. I can't get there and hold on to that. I used to think that a spiritual experience was the destination in Alcoholics Anonymous. That was the end result. Some years ago, I realized that that's just the beginning. That's the starting point. Because without a spiritual experience, I'm not capable of practicing these principles in all my affairs without being in fit spiritual condition. And I'm not capable of carrying this message to another alcoholic. I'm not even interested in carrying this message to another alcoholic if I'm not in fit spiritual condition. And I realized I have to give it away. And I need new guys to tell my story to. I need new guys to share my experience with. I need guys to remind me of what it was like in case I forget. Don't get me wrong when I say this, but I think the allergy is overrated. All I mean by that is I think we talk about it disproportionately to the obsession. But you know, I haven't had a problem with the allergy for 24 and a half years. Mickey hasn't had it for 34 years, and Millie hasn't had it for, Mildred, for since 44. And Coleman today, 54. But I can tell you, hardly a week passes that I don't get a little nip of the ringer in terms of the obsession. You know, and the chapter more about alcoholism tells me that I need a spiritual experience to overcome the obsession, not to overcome the allergy. I can't do anything about my reaction. I can't change my reaction to drinking. But I can change my reaction to not drinking. And I needed to change my reaction to not drinking, you know. So I need those guys to remind me of that, because I am incapable of keeping in my consciousness with sufficient force the pain, humiliation, suffering of even a week or a month ago. What about 24 and a half years ago? So I need to do that. And I need a program of recovery to try and make living today less anxiety-laden than it used to be. And the day when, in my thick head, living today without a drink becomes more painful or more difficult than my memory of how it was a drink, it's just like a Wayne scales. I'll drink. It's just gravity. And the white rabbit will be out there and the trick will be over. It's just like walking out on a teeter-totter. And then I walk over that teeter-totter and bang, I'm down. And I know that. And nature abhors a vacuum, you know? I always say the forest will take back the farm. And it will. You know, I was just down in Machu Picchu with my wife, the lost city of Machu Picchu, and when that got discovered by whoever it was, Bingham, whatever, from Yale University, at the beginning of the last century, it was entirely overgrown. Entirely overgrown. You could hardly see it. The forest had taken, the jungle had taken over it again. And so the forest will take back the farm. And my steps will unravel the same way as I got them. And it happens real easy. It's just like white noise. You know, you're in a building, it's white noise. There's fans, there's air conditioners, there's electricity. We don't even know it's there. You ever get a power outage, and all of a sudden the silence is deafening. And the silence is deafening because I suddenly realize what noise was going on. And that's been the same for me. My only experience of serenity is when not serenity is taken away, you know? My only experience of happy, joyous, and free is when not being happy, joyous, and free gets taken away. You know, so I need guys for that. And I realize today that the 12th step of Alcoholics Anonymous is like having a front row seat at the greatest show on earth. It really and truly is. Because we don't see it with ourselves, but we see it with others. And when we see the change that happens in people, and we see people transformed and smiles coming onto faces and children starting to laugh, going on their first holiday, people reconciling whether they get back together or not. We get to see the power of Alcoholics Anonymous. We get to see it right in front of us. And there's nothing better than somebody who's right fresh. It's like a before and after washing powder commercial, you know. They're great, aren't they? But I'll tell you, a washing powder commercial would be no good if you didn't see the garment before it went into the wash. So when you get to see that transition, it's just absolutely unbelievable. I got sober thanks to the intensive work of others with me. I was the recipient of intensive work of others with me less. You know, when we say, and because of people like you and rooms like this, you know, we all lived happily ever after, that wasn't the way it was for me. You know, when Goldilocks gets invited back to Cook Forest every year by the Three Bears and has her own cabin, you know, it wasn't like that. Les put time into me. Les put intensive time into me, you know. It was a very intensely personal relationship, you know. And I got sober because of people like Les and other people. And today I stay sober partly through my intensive work with others. And one of the wonderful magical things about Alcoholics Anonymous is it doesn't seem to matter which end of that you're on. But somehow, when two people come together and our higher power is present, it's like an electrical circuit. And it doesn't matter where we are on that circuit. My sobriety, my spiritual condition seems to get recharged. You know? And I get my energy from people, but I get my perspective from solitude. And Alcoholics Anonymous transformed my loneliness into solitude. And the difference for me between loneliness and solitude is there's no room in loneliness. It's all coming in on top of me in loneliness. but in solitude, it's there. So I need to keep sticking around. I need to keep helping guys. I need to keep trying to practice a program, keep trying to re-energize. I had become a great observer of you people and the people, as our speaker last night said, haven't had our experience. But I didn't know anything about me. And I've tried to develop an observer quality in my life. I've tried to observe what's happening inside me. Because life is what happens inside me. Life is not what happens outside me. You know? And when I can do that, I can try and grow that conscious contact, and I can try and grow that perspective into a day. So that hopefully one day when a guy drives by in a red Camaro, I won't be halfway out in the street with my finger up in the air. You know? So I've tried to do that, and you know, I had an experience 2 years ago. I had an accident. I ended up 6 hours of surgery, 2 weeks in the hospital, 4.5 months in a wheelchair. And I was non-weight-bearing on this arm and this leg on the same side, so I couldn't move. And I woke up after the operation, and by the Monday evening, the next day, I was completely depressed because the surgeon had told me they had to keep moving me every 2 hours and prop me up with pillows. And then two big guys would come down and pick me up and put me on the commode. And one of them would take a wet face cloth, one would take a dry face cloth, put me back in bed. Surgeon told me, we're going to have to move you to a veterans hospital because we're going to have to do this for at least 6 weeks. And I said, well, my wife said she wants to look after me at home. He said, oh, don't worry, she'll get over that. And I was really depressed. And I was lying there, and I thought, where's all this negativity coming from? How does this square away with my beliefs? And in that moment, I thought, there's an opportunity in this. I don't know what it is, but there's an opportunity. If I knew what it was, it wouldn't be an opportunity. It would be an expectation or a demand. And I'm just going to go with this. And it seemed to be, for me, the experience, like in the book, when it says God is either everything or he's nothing, what is their choice to be? That's how that translated for me. And the next morning, the surgeon asked me, was I okay? Do I need any narcotics? And I said, no, I'm okay. He said, don't be a hero. I said, I'm not being a hero. He said, you got to have a lot of pain. He said, your wrist was halfway up your arm. You've got more metal in your arm than the bionic man. And I've put screws 3 inches up in the neck of your femur that got severed. And you got to have intense pain. I said, I don't have any pain. And I didn't have any pain. I had some Tylenol. I had some ibuprofen. And all I know is that it ceased being a negative experience. And, you know, I decided not to fill my 4.5 months with Netflix or books or whatever. And I just watched what was going on inside me. And I learned a lot about me. I learned about my expectations of my wife and my children and other people.